This is CSAP Science and Policy Podcast, where we're bringing you the latest evidence and expertise to improve public policymaking. This week, we're proud to present the 13th episode in our series on science, policy, and pandemics. This episode is brought to you in partnership with Cambridge Infectious Diseases and the Cambridge Immunology Network. In this episode, our host, Dr. Rob Doubleday, and guest host Selma Shah are joined by Dr. Sean Fitzgerald and Mats Persson.
Welcome to the CSAP Science and Policy Podcast. I'm joined again by my co-host and former government advisor, Selma Shah. Hello, Selma.
Hello.
Today, we're going to talk about the science, the policy, the decision-making around the easing of restrictions. Now, clearly, that's a top political priority and one that requires the best scientific and engineering advice as we think about the transmission of the disease and then what's possible in terms of opening up schools, pubs, restaurants, offices, public transport, getting the economy going and getting public services going and getting normal life up and running again. It's clearly fraught with uncertainties, huge political pressures. Today, we want to hear from engineer, a policy advisor and economist about how some of these decisions are working in practice at the moment.
We are also interested in the economics and politics. So we want to explore how government can improve its use of science. To help us do this, we are joined by engineer Sean Fitzgerald, former advisor to the Prime Minister David Cameron, and Chancellor Sajid Javid, Mats Persson. Welcome to you both.
Sean, you're an engineer. You've looked at ventilation of buildings for a couple of decades now. And I know that you're currently advising government on the environmental questions about the transmission of the disease, how to model it, how to understand the transmission. Could you start by giving us a sense of what the state of knowledge is about the transmission of COVID and what can be done to reduce the risks? I know you're currently contributing your expertise to government through the SAGE process, but it's important to make clear here you're not speaking as a representative of the SAGE working group, but in your personal capacity as a Royal Academy of Engineering visiting professor at Cambridge.
The current understanding is that there are three principal mechanisms by which this horrible disease can be transmitted from an infected person to another. And they're as follows. First of all, particles that emanate from an infected person's airway can impale themselves directly onto a neighboring person. Mechanism two is probably those larger droplets don't actually go directly onto somebody. They fall onto a surface, and then an uninfected person touches that surface with their hand and then touches their face, and they have been infected. Mechanism three is where actually some of the particles emanating from somebody's airway are smaller and they linger around in the air for much longer. We call them aerosols, and therefore they get dispersed within the environment. And then they are inhaled by an uninfected person. The evidence base for the first two mechanisms is still currently stronger than the evidence base for the third. But an absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. And therefore, we really believe the third potential mechanism is still important to consider in developing risk mitigation strategies in your operation of your building.
Presumably, we're seeing research being done rapidly now. When can we expect to get a stronger sense of that third mechanism, the very fine particles in the air?
There is research going on. The one big thing that we still don't know is what we call the dose threshold, the amount of virus that you need to inhale in order to have a, let's say, a 50% chance of becoming infected. That's still a big unknown. And yet, if you want to sort of really get to grips with what's the likelihood of somebody being infected, you need to be able to have that in your armory so that you can then assess the different mechanisms and the importance of, for example, mechanism three, and just how real it is. We still don't know.
It's a topic of research, but as you say, decisions have to be taken now on the basis of our best understanding.
The appropriate approach is to take precautions. One of the things that the Chartered Institute of Building Services Engineers has done is to advise building owners to ventilate their buildings as much as practically possible. So bringing in more fresh air to help dilute that air. So if there are any virus particles that have been generated and shared by an infected person, to get that concentration down as much as possible. That's the advice that's been given. It's not to the extent that actually you make those environments unpleasant, because people need to be inside for good reasons, for working, for studying, for shopping, whatever it is. So you bring in as much fresh air as possible, that it's still within tolerable limits. The areas that probably concern us most are the areas that are poorly ventilated. There was a rather well-documented case of a restaurant in China around Chinese New Year, and the ventilation system was actually not functioning. They weren't actually operating it. And the amount of air being provided to guests was of the order 1 liter per second per person. That's about an order of magnitude lower than the building regulation minimum ventilation in the UK. So in this restaurant, there were a number of cases of transmission. We don't know, but it's believed that the airborne transmission route may have played a significant role in that particular instance. And hence, we are taking the precautionary approach of advising people to make sure that they don't have poorly ventilated spaces when there are multiple people either occupying that space at one time or one following another.
What do we do with that kind of knowledge, that kind of understanding, when there's such huge pressures to get restaurants up and running again?
On the ventilation angle itself, the restaurant case was one where the ventilation rate was so low, it wouldn't even meet current building regulation standards, and certainly wouldn't even meet standards that I'm aware of, even in the last 10 years. If you had very, very poorly ventilated spaces, then A, they're a risk for this particular disease. B, they would also be unpleasant just for regular use. And one would hope that it would be under the review of A, the building managers themselves, that there may be rooms that they should not be using, irrespective of COVID-19. But the way that building regulations are actually enforced, it's usually at the point where a building is either being commissioned for the first time or after it's had some serious building work done as a retrofit. There aren't that many checks for example, buildings which are, let's say they're naturally ventilated, we've been in them ourselves, where the windows are openable and then they get painted shut. You know, this is a big question, what are the teeth, what are the mechanisms to make sure that actually we haven't then created internal environments that aren't well ventilated? Clearly, those are of great concern, so that building managers should be looking at their building and making sure that the equipment that they've got, it might be fans, it might be something as simple as opening windows, make sure that they are operating as they were originally intended.
You have to have some view about how well will these guidelines be adopted and enforced. So how much confidence do you have that, you know, were new guidelines to be given to building owners, schools, restaurants, that those people responsible for implementing them would do so well and would be found out if they did so badly?
I'm optimistic that actually businesses want to provide, and many, many businesses do care about their employees. I mean, I think the ones that don't are the ones that don't survive, and they're certainly the few that make the headlines. Many, many businesses do, and for good reason, because that's how they then stay in business. They care about their employees. So actually listening to the HSE and similar organizations gives me great optimism that there will be people wanting to make working environments safe.
Now, Matt, you're a former advisor to a prime minister, former advisor to a chancellor. Now, listening to what Sean has just said, how possible is it for someone in your position to be able to even have the access to this kind of evidence? What are you depending on when you're making these sorts of decisions?
So in terms of the scientific data, right? I mean, you are quite reliant on scientists on this. You've seen that in the UK. You've also seen that in how many governments across the world have responded. So there's an element of taking scientific evidence on its face value and relying on deep experts on translating that for you. I think the problem, you know, that certainly we've seen here and that I can relate to is that if you look at governments across Europe in particular, they are taking slightly different interpretations of the science. So sort of there isn't, to some extent now, and I'm saying this with a bit of caution, but to some extent, the varying interpretations of the science seems to be driven also in part by things like the economics, clearly, but also things like the politics and also a bit the culture, right? That there's a culture element of this behind this. I'm from Sweden, for example, right? And that's kind of one of the most interesting counterfactuals I think we have in a country that partly based on politics, partly based on culture, but partly based on a different interpretation of the science has taken a very different approach. So I think there is a scientific body of evidence that is in part moving, in part fluid, but that is also interpreted through the lens of some very distinct cultural, political, and economic factors. And I think that's the challenge that I certainly would have had if I had been on the inside now.
What you're looking at now, Mats, in terms of debates about opening up, in terms of speed, or better, also perhaps in kind of what measures should be taken, how do you see the science and the kind of practical policy and the politics interplaying in the UK at the moment?
Yeah, I think there is an element of, is the science united, right? Is the scientific evidence unambiguous? And we just heard from Sean that, you know, in this, on the third transmission mechanism, there's still a bit of ambiguity as to how high risk that is. So I think there's an element there in the first instance of just trying to get to a point where you get a sense of, is the scientific consensus around something? And if it isn't, then that becomes the more complicated, because then you don't have full view of the trade-off. And I'm not saying this as someone who used to be in the Treasury, but clearly I think the economic aspects are becoming increasingly important as we get more understanding of how both consumers and businesses are reacting to the lockdown and the lockup. So if I sit in the Treasury now, clearly I'm really worried about, for example, about unemployment, right? Which is arguably one of the bigger economic and social challenges that will come out of this crisis. Unemployment creates challenges around consumer confidence, for example. There's strong correlation between unemployment rates and consumer confidence. So that in itself holds back recovery. But I also think more fundamentally about the long-term scarring of things like unemployment and what it does to some group. You know, we know already now from the data that there is a very large disproportionate number of people between 18 and 24 that have been furloughed and are losing their jobs. And that scarring effect on that group, it becomes very problematic, right? If we look at historic data, for example, if you look at the unemployment crisis in the 1980s, if you were a 23-year-old entering into the labor market or trying to enter into the labor market in 1981, you'll still be paid around 20% less 2 decades later than your peers, right? So, or than your peers that entered in sooner or later. So there is a very big economic impact that is coming to the fore here, that now it's coming up against the scientific evidence. If the scientific evidence is unambiguous and clear, then you can make that trade-off. But when it is a sense of that the scientific evidence is fluid, then I think you start to see more and more economic evidence sort of overtaking.
There is, it may not be necessarily different governments interpreting scientific data in different ways, but it might be a case of applying it in different ways. And this is important. We're all aware, for example, of different countries applying different distances between people that are deemed to be safe. But the scientific basis of any given recommendation is trying to ensure that a given risk factor of somebody acquiring an infection is down at that time is a satisfactory level. But the risk factors themselves are multiple. So it isn't just about the distance. It is about, for example, the prevalence of the disease, in other words, the potential for there being an infection person in your vicinity. So the prevalence in society, and that will vary from country to country depending on where they are on the curve. And then other factors such as the orientation, the duration of exposure, whether they're using face covering or not. All of these they're combined factors that need to be sort of considered in terms of establishing the overall risk. And therefore the interpretation of how one government wishes to apply this knowledge can vary, because they might use different levers. So they might decide it's just going to be 2 meters, whereas others might say, well, actually, we're going to introduce other things to try and achieve what is appropriate in that country at that given time. They might have a different prevalence rate. They might decide to combine a smaller distance, but with the use of a face covering and limiting the time that you should be in less than 2 meters for, you know, a very short period. There are different factors at play. An alternative way of sort of thinking about why the world has got these different measures in place might be just the fact that they're applying the scientific knowledge in different ways, because it is an international cohort of data, and we're all sharing across countries. I know that, you know, people do discuss this across borders, about scientists in one country discussing with scientists in another, what does this mean?
you know, when you're in a central decision-making position and you have, you know, interdisciplinary science that's coming at you. And so it's not necessarily your department in the Treasury that's looking at it. So there'll be the Department for Health that's looking at this piece. And then you are looking at the economic piece. How did those two things interplay? Is it through the cabinet discussion process? Is it through the Treasury reaching out? I mean, how much would you have factored in the sort of public health advice into what you were thinking about in what you just talked about with employment figures?
If there was only one single answer in how different parts of the government work together, neatly, then, you know, we would be maybe in a different situation. But so I think it's you know, it's a little bit what does a crisis management structure internally look like, and that's going to vary a little bit, right? And I don't want to comment too much on what the government has and has not been doing, but I would say you know, things like this come together, and there clearly is a structure in place around how government handles crises, and this is a crisis, including the COBRA structure, including you know, different parts of the government come together to try to reach that very, very difficult set of decisions, navigating a series of trade-offs. But to be honest, this is novel, right? Like, it's not as if anyone in this government has experienced anything similar before. So some of this has clearly also been, I wouldn't call it ad hoc because that is not the case, but it will have been different set of discussions that have brought people together. And just two points, I think, on that. You know, one is, it is very different. I mean, you will have different institutional interests depending on departments, right? The Treasury will be naturally more concerned with the economy. The Department, you know, of Health, for Health, will be naturally more concerned with the health picture. It's not that so neat that you can sort of just put public health and economy as if they were sort of mutually exclusive objectives. Of course, the two go together. So you have to weigh everything together. The way it works at its best is if you have that, you know, very kind of strong evidence-based discussion where you bring together the different pieces of the puzzle, if you will, from different departments, but you have some sort of way to kind of measure and weigh the materiality of different aspects. You want to have as a holistic picture as possible, clearly, with evidence stacking up along the way, not only looking at COVID-19 in isolation. And I think that is the way it needs to work, in particular in this instance, health, the economy, business. DWP is important because they do unemployment, etc., and get that holistic picture. That's the way decision makers should be working, right? And everything needs to be underpinned by evidence, not jumping from one headline to another. Now, that is not always how it works in practice, but that's how it should work.
You just talked about having you know, weighting all the different evidence bases. How can you possibly come to a decision? What's the primary thing that you have to care about at this point when we are coming out of lockdown? Is it going to be the economy, or is it going to be what we do for the second wave? Because the decision for the Chancellor right now is, you know, is he just going to borrow to the hilt?
I think the borrowing is one element of it, right? But I think it's sort of more, perhaps more pressing than the borrowing is just the kind of the fundamental scarring to the economy that might take many, many years to recover from. And I think trying to address that, or trying to reduce wherever you can, trying to get to a point where you weigh the health risk involved versus the long-term scarring on the economy. And that is very difficult because you're not necessarily comparing like for like. But to take the example of moving from 2 meters to 1 meter, yes, I get that is increasing the risk, right? That clearly is increasing the risk. Quite naturally, people come closer together. I mean, that's common sense. But you also need to look at what this disproportionate impact that would have in terms of getting the economy up and going again. In the restaurant sector, for example, I mean, the common measure is that if they have to go 2 meters apart, if they stick to the 2 meter rule, they can probably generate about 25-30% of the revenue. But if you move to 1 meter, that goes up to 70-80%. And that makes a huge difference in terms of avoiding unemployment in the autumn. So I would probably, on that basis, sort of, you know, and this might be controversial, but I would probably move to 1 meters, right? Now, Sean needs to tell me why I'm wrong.
I mean, I'm just going to talk about, you know, actually the science about the risk factors of this particular disease. And as I said earlier, it is not all about just a distance. Fundamentally, I think I've already said it, but we'll start with the prevalence in society. So when you say, you know, a country's got better numbers than the UK, well, if they've got a lower prevalence, then the overall risk therefore just that one factor alone is lower. And if you were caring about actually what your risk of acquiring infection is, that's actually really, it's an important variable. But there are others as well. And, you know, I'm aware that restaurants have opened up in Hong Kong, but you are expected, if you go to Hong Kong, to wear a face covering as you go into the restaurant. You take it off when you're at the table with your household. But if you move from the table to go to the restroom or whatever, then you're expected to wear the face mask. That's number one. Number two, I actually think there are, if you think about the duration of contact in terms of close proximity, I think there are massive opportunities, I think, for businesses. Restaurant sector, let's consider this. The role of technology and how you place your order. If you just think about the number of contacts that you're potentially going to have, you have, you're welcome to when you come in. That's very nice. And we all enjoy that. Then somebody often takes a drinks order. That's very lovely. They come and bring you drinks. Then they come and take your food order. And so how many of these contacts with what you've got in your pocket, namely an amazing computer, and you pay for things from your computer when you're not in a restaurant, you can buy on the street. Why don't we do this in these other environments? And I get excited thinking about these sorts of things because maybe it's a way for certain businesses to actually not compete locally, but to compete globally. Actually, we're going to go and build. Somebody said, oh, Sean, you're going to be losing jobs because you haven't got as much face time. No, we're changing jobs. Actually, we've got, because the software doesn't come for free. Somebody's got to write it. Somebody's got to sell it. And actually, the world is your stage now in terms of your business opportunity. So I think some of these challenges that are being raised by the current crisis will be catalysts for creative thinking as to how we might actually go and rethink some sections of society and some sections of business.
You know, clearly in your vision there will be some winners, but then there's going to be some losers. And so, you know, the companies that maybe have the capital, the human capital, or the cash to buy, you know, very good value advice from consultants who can come in, you know, may stand to gain. And companies that don't, you know, small family-owned businesses that don't have that kind of resource, you know, are going to lose. So that is the kind of issue, I guess, that politicians are going to be grappling with when they think about how to phase these kind of decisions.
I mean, I do a lot of work on this, right? And I totally agree. Clearly, it is an interesting trigger point, and there is a way it can sort of facilitate ways to do things better. But the problem we have at the moment is that we literally have, I think, over 10 million workers on furloughed. That's a quarter of the entire workforce. And many of these jobs, absent some changes, will no longer de facto exist, right? So you're moving into the autumn where a very large chunk of the population could potentially be unemployed. And it has a disproportionate impact on the lower wage, sort of the lower earners, turning the crisis uncertainty into an opportunity, you know, the holy grail of all management consultants everywhere. But I think there is a very real social, political, economic challenge which will play out over the next 12 months that have to be addressed somehow.
This is the classic sort of evidence political split, I think, which is, Sean, what you're talking about is actually how the world is changing and how you can find opportunity from this. But this is like a medium to long-term endeavor in terms of changing and reducing contact points. I mean, you might disagree with me on that. You're the engineer, you know better than I do. So, I mean, Matt, I think I'm right in saying my concern around that would be, you know, people need action immediately. And this, whilst you can accept what Sean is saying and the premise of that is that it opens up this whole new world of doing things differently, actually, you know, you have to make decisions right now and for businesses that could go under in the next quarter.
How the risk factors get applied is up to the politicians, but I would, you know, the clarity of the science is that it's not just about a distance. There are multiple risk factors. I'll take the extreme example, which is New Zealand right now, which until a couple of days ago hadn't had any cases for, 20 plus days. And they've lifted all measures. But the reason why they've lifted all measures is the prevalence in society was ridiculously low. Therefore, it's a continuum. So as things change over time, then it doesn't surprise me that policies change over time. And therefore, and it's up to others in government to think about what the science and how it gets applied.
One of the big responsibilities of governments and ministers is to communicate all of this in a tangible, accessible way. I just wonder what your thoughts are about how you interact with the public then, which is obviously a huge factor in the success of dealing with COVID-19, when you've got the science and the evidence base behind that you need to explain.
I mean, it's the ultimate communication challenge, right? It's looking at the Swedish example or the German example, for example, right? Where, you know, Angela Merkel, she's sort of, her way to communicate is communicating through complexity. In some ways, she does the exact opposite of what the government has done here, right? Which is working with three slogans. These two governments have communicated. They have communicated, at least initially, in very different ways, but it has sort of mostly cut through. And now, of course, here in the UK, it's more complicated, but the initial communication campaign was pretty effective.
Sean and Matt, thank you so much. I have to say, this has been one of the most enjoyable discussions because you've both come at it from such unique perspectives, and having it's completely encapsulates the difficult decisions that governments have to make. And these are completely different perspectives and the judgment is based on them. So I'm really, really fascinating.
Thank you very much.
CSAP Science and Policy Podcast is a production of the Center for Science and Policy at the University of Cambridge. This episode of our series on science, policy, and pandemics has been brought to you in partnership with Cambridge Infectious Diseases and the Cambridge Immunology Network. This episode was hosted by Dr. Rob Doubleday and Selma Shaw, and was produced by me, Kate McNeil. Our guests this week were Dr. Sean Fitzgerald and Matt Person. You can learn more about CSAP's work by visiting us on Twitter at CSIPOL or by visiting our website at www.csap.cam.ec.uk. If you have feedback about this episode or questions you'd like us to address in a future week, please email inquiries@csap.cam.ec.uk. Thanks for listening.